understand these things myself as much as I would like to. But let's see. So I'm going to explain a little bit about Dyck-Raff-Witten theory, which is a kind of a toy example of a TQFT. And I'd like to start from kind of the physicist's definition and then try to turn this into its Frobenius algebra. And so calculate its underlying Frobenius algebra, which, as we saw last time, kind of can also be used, or would be the functorial point of view, and defines the theory as kind of a finite algebraic structure. Okay, so we have to fix a finite group G. This is going to be like a, so this is a gauge group. And it's kind of a toy theory or a toy model because G is going to be finite. Finite group, so we don't have to worry about any kind of differentiable structure or whatever. And we're going to consider on our manifolds principal G bundles. So, which are like topological excitations in gauge theory, like instantons. And so in the case of a finite group G, what this boils down to, a G bundle P over a manifold M is just like a covering space. If you know what this is, with a G action. So what this means is that we have sort of a total space, okay, a manifold P and a projection map down to M. So let me just give an example in the case of the group Z2, which is this two elements, so the two element group. So then it's and M being the circle S1. So if this is the circle, this is circle S1. And we can take P to be either just two copies of S1. Let me draw these like so. Well, I'm not sure. This is not a good drawing, I guess. And the picture would just be the projection so that we have kind of over each point here, it has two points as its pre-image. And so on these two points, the group acts by just permuting these two points. So this is a group with two elements. It has the unit element, which acts trivially. And it has one non-trivial element, which just permutes these two points. And this is the same over each fiber. And so principle and covering space means that when we look at this locally, so not just infinitesimally, meaning at a single point, but when you do this locally, meaning in an open neighborhood, then this is supposed to look like exactly this product M times the group G, right? So this is then a principal bundle means. Yes, so there's another principal bundle over the circle with gauge group Z2, which doesn't look like just like this product, but which has a twist in it. And so this would be kind of the two circles crossing. Well, I'm not sure how I should draw this. Like this, I guess. So, right, yeah. So again, every point on the circle here has two points. This is pre-image, right? And we have this action of the group here, but this is topologically non-trivial. and still it locally looks like a product. So yeah. What else did I want? I'm not sure it has, I don't know if it has a name. I mean, this is just a kind of a simple example, right? So this is just, well, this is just a non-trivial principle bundle. Yeah. And note that in the finite case, because we have a finite group here, this principle bundle automatically comes with a connection. So in the case of a connection meaning, So, well, I guess it's better to consider the bundle itself than as the gauge field. So in the case of a Lie group, gauge field would mean bundle together with the connection. But in this case, the connection is unique. Because, well, speaking in terms of differential forms, value with values in the Lie algebra, the Lie algebra is zero here. So there is this doesn't make sense. But connection means a way to once you fix a curve in the manifold, in the base manifold, and at the starting point of the curve, so let's say this is the starting point and this is the end point, then this should give you a unique way to map the fiber from the starting point to the end point, to the fiber of the end point. So this is what connection means, right? So in differential geometry, connection, you can specify a connection in terms of how it does parallel transport, right, of vectors along curves. In a gauge theory, we can specify a connection also by how it does parallel transport. What kind of, for example, in electrodynamics, what kind of phase you pick up when you go along a curve. This is what a connection means. Is that clear? And also, so here, you can, so locally, I mean, locally, you can identify the fiber with the group itself. And so in this case, we can even do it globally. We can just pick one of the two circles. It doesn't matter which one. We can call one of them zero, and we can call the other one one. Then going around, just, I'm not sure how to say that. Well, anyway, so this is something we can do in this case, right? We can just, so in this case, also the total space is connected, so we can't just label it in some way with the group elements, but we can still do this locally. Locally meaning that if we fix an open set, a small enough open set in the base, we can identify the principal bundle over that part with the sheets. We have sheets indexed by the group elements. Right, yes.
But we, I think we will see some example of about what can be a gauge connection in the remainder anyway. But we will use that.
Yeah. So in this case, the important thing to note is just that there is a unique way to lift curves, to lift a curve from the base to the total space, to the bundle, once you fix a lifting of the initial point of the curve. So, is it clear what I mean?
Two things. One is that so the Lebesgue, I can think about some kind of Z2 gauge theory, living on the S1 space.
A gauge field, yeah. Uh-huh.
And how about the right-hand side?
Also, this is also a gauge field, but then now this has a kind of instanton on it, if you want. So this is actually just like, you know, in the Dirac monopole.
Yeah.
Once you go around the monopole, basically you pick up a non-trivial phase, right?
Yeah.
So this is kind of the same here. Once you go, so this is if you think of this as the space, you go once around the circle, this is like going once around the Dirac monopole. And in this case, when you go once around and you look at what happens in the total space here, you will end up at the other point. So this is also like saying you picked up a non-trivial phase. Phase in this case being a group element.
Change this bundle,
uh-huh.
The Z2 one, change it to continuous.
Say, yeah.
S whatever, SU2.
Mm-hmm.
Then, what's the picture? Maybe there's also non trivial winding.
It
can have only
S2. You, right. S2. Yes,
so
yes.
Let's take a S2 or maybe S3. S3 is a better. SU2.
Uh-huh.
SU2 is like S3.
SO3, yeah.
Uh-huh. So you can have a non-trivial one.
Yes. But the difference being that in the case of a Lie group, the connection is not unique.
Yes.
There is no unique way to specify how what kind of phase you pick up when you go around the loop.
Yes.
When you have, once you know, even if you know the principal bundle, then there's no the connection is not uniquely defined.
Yes.
You need to fix the gate, and additionally, this, you know, gauge field or something, right? Which is, that's basically what connection means.
Yes.
But in this case, because the group is finite,
yes,
specifying this bundle itself already fixes the connection.
Yes.
There's a unique way now to go, to pick up the face once it's enough to know this kind of topological structure of this bundle here, this bridge bundle of projection.
But in the case of SU2, you also have some kind of monopole, right? It's just related to some winding.
Well, in the case of the Dirac monopole, for example, the thing is that we have this sort of singularity. That we have this line which we do not consider as part of our space. So this is like this circle here. So in the case of the Dirac monopole, I guess the what we would consider would be something like R3 minus the line defined by this or something, no?
Mm-hmm.
Minus one of the axes, let's say. Because there, the gauge field is just not defined, right? So this is why what happens in the Dirac monopole case, for example, is that we actually consider this topologically non-trivial manifold as our space, just like we here consider the circle. I mean, from a topological point of view, this is equivalent to the circle. This is homotopy equivalent to a circle. Now, for later use, it'll be useful to have a way to classify these principal bundles. And, well, basically, it turns out that when our manifold M is connected, it's enough to specify this kind of phase we could pick up when we go around loops. So this actually Valentin already kind of used this 2 weeks ago, that when we look at the collection of G bundles, or we can actually even consider this as a category of bundles, then this is equivalent, or there's a natural bijection to... No, I guess I should explain this. But let me write it down first. To the homomorphisms from the fundamental group of M to G. So let me see if this is clear. So when I give you a principal bundle, how do you turn this into a homomorphism? Okay, well, you know about the fundamental group of a manifold?
Yeah.
Or if a topological space in general?
Can you say why this is pi 1?
Hmm?
You write pi 1 of M.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, so this is the fundamental group of M, which... You know what this means? Sorry. Yeah, okay. So this is the group of loops in the manifold M. Now, so fix your manifold M and choose your favorite point in that manifold, just to fix a point, an arbitrary point, and consider all loops from that point to itself on the manifold. So, for example, on a torus, I'm fixing a point, and I consider all continuous paths from this point to itself. So, I can just do this, or I can go around here, or I can go around this way, down on the bottom, and come back. So this would be examples of, so these are all loops on a torus.
But you can also have a trivial one, I mean.
Yeah, yeah, so this was the first one. Okay, or actually the constant one, the loop which just doesn't move anywhere and stays at that point.
So this could be Z I mean, cross the M, and M is different,
is that right?
Z, I mean,
for torus. Yeah, in the case of, well, I'll explain why in the torus it'll be set to, yeah, yeah. Yeah. No. No. We don't even have a metric on here. This is just a manifold without any additional, just topological. No, no metric structure, nothing.
It's counting the number of distinct winding numbers.
But fundamental, yeah, kind of. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You wrap around and then you go this one, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's two types.
Yeah, okay, you could also do both. Just like, you could go like, kind of like this.
And, well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
In the case of torus, and a common cycle, like the wrong stay, because you're in this field, like logical subspace, so core subspace, only a wrong stay degeneracy, you have an alphamale homology cycle, that's the name of the field.
I've heard of logical operators on toric nodes, I don't know what about homological or whatnot.
The cycle, yeah, the cycle that you have. On the
core subspace. Well, doesn't matter.
Yeah,
now.
Take a cycle, and I do Z's all the way around in a loop.
That's the same.
Right.
Let's maybe finish the definition for in the. Yeah. So, and we consider two of these loops to be equivalent if we can fill in a surface between them. Okay. So for example, this little loop here. Is equivalent to the constant loop, which just stays there, because we can fill in the surface here. So, well, technically this is called that the loops are homotopic, just in case you've heard the term. But now, for example, this one, this is not homotopic to the constant loop, because I can't, well, there's no way, whatever way I would try to fill in a surface between this thing and the constant loop, it doesn't work. So this is an equivalence relation on the set of loops. And if we take equivalence classes, we typically get kind of a discrete set of equivalence classes. So when the manifold is compact, it's guaranteed to be a discrete set of equivalence classes. And, well, it's called fundamental group. So far we have a set. Now how do we turn the set into a group? The thing is that we can compose these loops. So when we have two representatives of equivalence classes, we can just first do the first one, then do the second one, and concatenating these two loops defines a new loop, and this turns out to be compatible with the equivalence relation of filling in surfaces. So in this way, we got a kind of binary operation on these equivalence classes, and it turns out that this is actually a group, because, well, the inverse would just be given by traversing a loop backwards. Yeah, so this is the fundamental group. And now when we have a principal G bundle for G, this finite gauge group, I was already saying that then we get these kind of phases when we go around loops. So in this way, the bundle defines us for every loop, we get a group element. Because, well, yeah, we just go around the loop and lift this loop to the total space. So lift the loop from the manifold M to the total space here. And then in general, we don't end up again at the same point on the bundle, but it's a different point, and we need to apply a certain group element to get from one of these points to the other. So this is the phase we pick up. So remember that these fibers have an action of the group, and so there's a unique way to go from one point in the fiber to another point in the same fiber, just given by multiplication of a certain group element, there's a unique group element. So in this way, we get an assignment of a group element to each loop. Just the phase we pick up by going around that loop. And now, what if we have two loops and we can draw in a surface between the two?
You're saying these relations isomorphism, or what do you want to say about this?
I'm trying to explain this this isomorphism. So I'm not trying to explain now when we have an element of here, so we have a G bundle, how we turn this into such a group homomorphism from this fundamental group to G. So far I've explained how we get how we assign a group element to each loop. But now, in order for this to be a group homomorphism, first of all, we needed to respect the equivalence relation here on these loops. But so we're saying the two loops are equivalent if we can fill in the surface between the two.
Yep. You can fill a surface. Can you tell me what do you mean by that?
Okay, so then let me write it down a bit more technically. So a loop is just, a loop is a function from a continuous function from the unit interval to M. So now let's say we have two loops, S1 and S2. Oh, and of course also S0, required to be equal to S of 1 and equal to the given base point P that we fix.
Can I say that the you can feel the surface of whatever space is a contractible loop, or is it equivalent to a contractible loop?
Well, this is being contractible is just the property of one loop, right?
Yes.
But basically, yes. This is what contractible is, also the technical term when it's just of one loop. Saying that the loop
yes.
is equivalent to the constant loop just means that the loop is contractible.
And that's the same statement, say that space, is there the same statement to say that the space winded by this loop can be filled? That's what you're
talking about. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I mean. So when we have two loops now, then we call them equivalent. Intuitively, we can fill in a surface between the two if there is a function R, which is now a continuous path of loops. So, in a sense that now we have two arguments. The first argument is still the same as here, so this is kind of parameterizes the loop. And the second argument parameterizes the loops themselves.
You continuously deform.
So this is required to be a continuous deformation between
from
the two
one
loops.
One path to the other path, to the two loops.
Yes. So in other words, if we take this second argument, so the deformation argument, fix it to be zero, we require that this recovers the first loop. And if we take it to be one, we require that this gives us back the second loop. And also, again, we also want to have that this is a continuous deformation. In order for it to be a continuous deformation of loops, it ought to be a loop at every point in between, right? At every value of the deformation parameter.
Yep.
So we should have that for every value of t, this is a loop. So, and what this boils down to now intuitively, if you think of this function as kind of defining a surface in M, this is a surface filled in between having S1 and S2 as its boundaries, roughly.
It's fine. But this is just homotopy between two.
Yeah.
But in that case, I saw that whether the surface can be filled, like whether you can have a contractible loop, right? It seems to me that's kind of. You want an extra condition that this surface doesn't have a hole. You know, it's actually should be totally continuous. You know, it should be filled.
Otherwise,
you don't have a hole in that.
Yeah.
Is it what you want?
Yeah, yeah. Sorry. So when I say surface, I mean just kind of this kind of rectangle here.
Yeah. But I'm saying that.
Or a disk or something. Yeah.
I guess ideally I get it, but I just say when you write down these maths, it seems like. You can have just two loops, which basically is should be a winding the one of the T2 torus direction, and then now if they are basically the same kind of cycle, and basically they can actually homotopy to each other.
Mm-hmm.
We are not saying this surface can be filled, right? I guess you are trying to say only the one that you can control is the one can be filled. Right? But this definition doesn't tell me the different that.
This is just homotopy, no?
This is homotopy.
Yeah.
But I guess, isn't that you are trying to ask the surface, what's the definition of surface? Can we deal?
It's not a definition. This is the definition.
Okay.
It was just kind of an intuitive, rough explanation.
Okay. Yeah, I guess this is not important. I guess I know the idea is you can go.
Sometimes when you finite surface, it needs to be in two parts in order for that to work.
What do you mean?
So this is my math fault. Alright, there's my point that I'm...
That looks way better than mine.
Alright.
Thank you. Do you have something here?
Point.
It's about 30. There's three people coming for the large ship.
Right, there's one.
At pitch time?
Yeah,
I suppose I do a second
coming,
one.
Yeah.
Like that.
Okay.
Now, under the rules as I understand them, that is equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So, but we have to, these cross here as well, so that means we have two areas that you have to cover in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, this surface can still have many self-intersections and kind of. Maybe saying surface was kind of bad. It's really just this kind of homotopy.
Well, I mean, you can think about it in terms of filling in one or more areas without filling the entire manifold.
Yeah, I guess.
Right, so if you try and do this...
No, you can also fill the entire manifold. That's not a problem.
Well, if I'm allowed to fill the entire manifold, then I can have two inequivalent loops looking equivalent. That breaks it if you allow them to fill the whole manifold.
Well, you have to fill it in the right way. You have to use the right definition of filling.
Well, you know, I'm thinking fill as in, remember old graphics programs where you have that thing and it all... often looks like a bucket of paint on the Microsoft. You pour it and it will fill that area, and if you've left any gaps, it will leak out and go everywhere.
Yeah, but that's not...
See, if I have my two things like this, right, which are not equivalent, and I'm allowed to fill the entire manifold,
But it's a bit more subtle than just filling it like that. Because also, for example, if traversing this loop in this way
mm-hmm.
and the other loop in that way is not equivalent, right? Although we can kind of fill in things in between.
Right.
All right, so now if we have such... So, yeah, please forget about the term surface. Let's say deformation, okay? It's about deforming one loop into the other continuously.
Mm.
All right. So if we do it,
the nip gamma.
Hmm.
That's this nip gamma.
Gamma? Which gamma?
It's R. Your surface.
Oh yeah. Sorry, it's just any letter.
If we take R for 0 point, what is it?
R.
On the first argument, what? Zero before?
Yes.
And point after. We vary our.
Yes, so this is P. This is the base point P because we require that, so in particular, also for zero here, this thing should be a loop based at P, of course. So this means that, yeah. So for every value of this argument here, this has to be loop based at P, so in particular also for zero, this has to be... No, sorry, the other way around. No. Yeah. This is the loop argument, right? This thing. Parameterizes the loops.
Yeah.
So for every value of this parameter, I don't know, x or whatever, for every x, this has to be a loop based at p. And therefore, if we take t to be 0, well, the initial point of every loop, which means taking t to be 0, this initial point has to be the base point. So that's how we get this. In any case, so it's about deforming loops into each other. No, what if we have this principal bundle and we look at the kind of the faces we get when we go around loops, then Then what about two loops we can deform into each other? Well, deforming a loop shouldn't change the phase by much, right? So it sort of has to be a continuous function of that loop. But now the group is finite, which means that there's nothing really we can, if we make a small deformation of the group, we can't deform the phase at all because the group is finite, so we can't make in kind of infinitesimal deformations, right? So this is why when we have two homotopic loops, so two loops that can be deformed into each other, they will get the same phase around when going around a loop. Case of this finite gauge group. So this is why we get a well-defined map from this fundamental group pi 1 to the gauge group. Now when we go around one loop first and then a second loop, then of course we will pick up the phase assigned to the first loop times the phase assigned to the second loop, where times is the group operation. So this is why we actually get a group homomorphism. And on the other hand, if we have a group homomorphism, these phases basically turn out to be enough to characterize the principal bundle. Assuming that the manifold M is connected. Because, well, then we basically, because then we essentially know, it's kind of hard to explain.
It's okay. If it's not really related to the end of the story, we can assume.
Well, no, yeah, it is, but I mean, this is one of the
because we don't want to start with something
important ingredients. Yeah.
We don't want to start with something we can check on the test book.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, but I think it's basically fine. But I'll just like to have some intuitive picture, like. How can I just see this without going through math? And I can
I know.
Bundle is just like attaching some kind of space on the base manifold and.
Okay. So what about?
That's fine. I guess the difference between the isomorphism on two sides that seems like the right hand side is the smaller space. Pi1m seems like just counting this space.
Yes, well, on both sides, we basically just have a finite set. Because G is a finite group, and while they're only finitely, that means that and when a manifold M is compact, this group here is, finitely generated.
So G cannot be legal? I mean, it cannot be continuous group.
It can be, but this is not the case where, I mean, and this still holds when G is a Lie group,
okay. But
this is just not the case that we're considering at the moment. Well, so Valentin was actually using this in the case of a Lie group. Okay, so now I have to talk a little about gauge transformations or equivalences of principal bundles. The thing being that, well, we can, how should I say this? So when we have this principal bundle, we can permute the fibers of the bundle, right? And in some cases, we can permute these in such a way that the bundle we get by permuting them is isomorphic to the original one. So this would be an automorphism of the bundle, which corresponds to a gauge transformation in this case.
Like this one, Z2, you can do a Z2.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yes. So in this case, we can apply the group action here in order to the only non-trivial isomorphism would consist in mapping this point here to that point, and just over every fiber permuting these two points. Right? So every fiber consists of two points, and we can just permute these two. And this is an automorphism of the bundle. And more generally, the automorphisms of the bundle are given by, now let's see if we can somehow figure out what exactly that means. So let's say when we have to find the bundle through a homomorphism like this, so from pi 1 of m to t, then the automorphisms of the bundle P associated to this phi are given by the set of all group elements G for which G phi, which commute essentially with all these faces assigned to the loops. Okay, so by this I just mean that for every loop S, this G thing has to commute. And so why is this? So in general, we need to permute the fibers in such a way that it doesn't disturb the faces we pick up when we go around the loops. Right? Because, well, these faces are kind of, the faces we pick up when going around loops, this is the gauge invariant data, so to speak. And now when we apply so the permutations on the fibers are given just by, they need to necessarily be given by multiplying with a fixed group element. So in the continuous Lie group case, you all know that gauge transformation is just given by sort of a function from the manifold to the gauge group, right? But so it turns out that in the case of a finite group, things are a bit different. And that is because if we want to permute, so permuting the fibers in some way, we require that to be compatible with the G action we have on the fibers. So that means that it can itself, in a sense, only be given by multiplication by a group element. But yeah, this is actually kind of a subtle point. Okay, well, I guess in a sense I don't understand this well enough myself to be able to explain it.
Score.
Yeah.
Maybe that's an ultimately the final goal of all.
So now maybe let's get to the definition of Dirac Fermat theory.
Yeah.
We can come back.
We can come back on that.
All right. So, well, a quantum field theory, as usual, should be defined in terms of an action, and in terms of, well, first of all, in terms of a sort of configuration space, right? Configuration space of all fields, in terms of an action on that configuration space, and in terms of something like a measure on that configuration space. So, our configuration space. It's just going to be this, the set of G bundles. Over the manifold M. So M is our space or space time.
So given the kind of space time, okay.
Yeah.
You find another configuration.
And this these are the fields we consider, which are just, so this is actually the same as if we just do ordinary gauge or Young-Mills theory with a finite gauge group. So in the Young-Mills case, we would have gauge fields, right? But as I said before, a gauge field is given by a G bundle plus the connection on that bundle. So in this case, the connection comes for free because, well, there's only one connection. The connection is unique. So in this case, with a finite group, gauge field is just the bundle itself. So this is like Young-Mills with a finite gauge group, at least on the level of the configuration space. Now we need to define the action. So this is just some function from the config, oh, and I should say this is this configuration space, as we can see from this, is actually a finite set.
Because G is finite.
Yes, because G is finite, and this pi 1 of M is finitely generated.
So what I get confused somehow that if G is not finite, it seems like the right hand side of homomorphism between pi 1 and M, which is normally a finite.
So in the case of a Lie group, this collection of homomorphisms is kind of a moduli space, I think, as Valentin called it.
Okay.
So it's in general also continuous. It may have singularities, so I guess it's not a manifold necessarily, but and it's definitely then also continuous.
Yeah, I just look into this isomorphism. I just feel like that seems to be isomorphism somehow. I just say that, just say, take T2 as example, the pi 1 M space is Z square, right?
The torus?
Yeah, so T square. T square,
yes.
Pi 1 M will be Z square.
Right.
And take G to be some.
So in this case, we get G times G. As the moduli space of bundles,
yes,
which just corresponds to the first vector corresponding to the phase we pick up when we go around, let's say, this loop.
Yes.
And the second factor corresponding to the phase we pick up when we go around that loop.
Okay.
Right, so a principal bundle in that case is defined by specifying these two phases. Maybe this actually gives a bit of an intuition for this equivalence,
okay.
This torus case.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and then, well, it's obvious, I guess, if G is finite, then this is also finite, right?
Yeah.
And also, well, maybe what I should have said at the beginning, that this finiteness, it may look a bit boring, and it's certainly not physically realistic in any sense, I guess. But it's a nice toy example of kind of a TQFT, which has all the essential features, but much less technical complications. So for example, well, okay, so finite set, the path integral is simple. Just, well, a finite sum. That's what we're going to see. Okay, so the action, well, it's also very simple. The action namely is zero, constant zero. Also, this is only because we're just looking at a particular case. So this is called the untwisted, this is the called untwisted Dijkhoff-Witten theory. One could also do this, kind of introduce a twist using some sort of group cohomology, or, and then this would become non-trivial.
Just to know, is it derived that the action is vanishing, or you just put it by hand like this?
You just put it by hand, like just define it to be zero.
Okay, I wanted to see what is zero.
I mean, from what assumptions could you make, or what could you derive it from?
Still, I wanted to see how can you use a field for defining this action, you know, before you make it vanishing. Anyway, so keep up.
Right, S is some function that you pulled out of your ear, right?
Yeah.
Why did it have to be zero?
Because it's the simplest case, we want to consider it the simplest case imaginable.
Okay, so suppose I pulled some other function out of my ear and say, like, well, arbitrarily, we're going to call this the action. Can you then derive the fact that this thing is twisted?
I don't know what that... Well, I mean, you can't write down an arbitrary function here, actually, but it needs to satisfy... I mean, it needs to be, in a certain sense, the integral of a local Lagrangian.
Right, okay, so there needs to be something... I mean, I would feel happier if we could see what the constraints are that a function has to satisfy in order to be an action.
It has to be the integral of a local Lagrangian, essentially. And this local Lagrangian has to be defined in a gauge invariant way. And, well, I mean, in this case, it just, well, our gauge transformation, the gauge transformations are essentially these automorphisms of the bundle, but I guess you don't even need to look at these in order to be able to say that something is gauge invariant, but you can just say it needs to be defined in kind of an invariant way, in the sense that you're not supposed to use any arbitrary choices while defining the action. Like fixing a particular element in the fiber and you know, this kind of stuff. Fixing a particular, it's called trivialization of the bundle. It's the equivalent of fixing a coordinate system in GR. So usually, actually, well, physicists in gauge theory, at least, this is something which is a bit of a mystery to me, in fact. Why physicists in GR have come to the point where they don't fix coordinate systems anymore, right? They also nowadays work in terms of manifolds and things.
Mm-hmm.
But in gauge theory, they still kind of fix arbitrary trivializations of principal bundles. Still work in terms of write on these things like A, mu, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which are not gauge invariant quantities.
Mm-hmm.
And this is using this as this kind of equivalent to in a certain precise sense the same thing as choosing coordinate systems in a manifold. Like,
yeah, well, it might be a case that they don't have a better way of doing it. And it may be a case that they don't have a better way of doing it. Right? I mean, in general relativity on its own, right, time is a coordinate and you transform it according to the rules of the diffeomorphism group, right? But in quantum mechanics, time is a parameter.
Yeah.
Right? And if you want to get the two to talk to each other, that kind of implicitly forces you to start fixing stuff, right? And it's not nice, but in the absence of a better method, that's what people continue to do.
Well, you should do. I suppose you should do quantum field theory anyway, rather than quantum mechanics. But
but you still get this problem kind of built in.
Well, that's not good. Sidetrack. No, with discussion.
You wanted to know why, and I was trying to tell you. So.
But anyway,
for common field theory, you can write down this full vector, and it's less the vector.
It's not quite as simple as that, because if it was, you could renormalize quantum gravity without any trouble.
I don't know quantum gravity.
Right, nobody does that. So.
No, that has nothing, anything to do with renormalizability.
No, I mean, I've been to talks by Lee Smolin when
yeah.
he points out that, you know, you have this completely different treatment of time between the two theories, and that's one of the reasons why they do not fit
yeah.
together.
And we're coming with anything.
Right? And using quantum field theory does not fix it, because we would not be having this conversation if it did fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This would be a solved problem, and it would be in the textbook.
Anyway, so the action is zero.
I want to just, Tobias, this S is an S of phi? Is it the S of phi? I just want to know what kind of variable can I put in that action?
Yes, a principal bundle. So this is a function, you know, the action is always.
So it should be an I, because you draw an isomorph, a normal, an equivalent between those G bundles and the homomorphism.
Uh-huh. Right,
so
yeah.
Can I just put there a phi, because I cannot put there
yes,
a G
yes,
bundle?
Yes, exactly, yeah.
All right, okay, good. This works.
So this is a function of phi, and in a general case, well, in the twisted case, it does depend on that phi in a non-trivial way. Now, we would like to define this sort of stuff, right? So in order to define this, we also need to define this kind of measure. So we also need to define a measure on the configuration space. And, well, okay, let me actually write mu here for a measure.
D mu
if you want. Well, I mean, it's all finite, right? So there's really not.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I'm just going to write mu of, which is just, so this turns into a finite sum, in fact, where this mu of phi is the weight associated to phi,
mm-hmm.
or the measure associated to phi. And so this should also be regarded as kind of a definition. This is part of the definition of the theory, although this is certainly this is also not arbitrary, just like the action can also not be arbitrary, but this also needs to satisfy certain locality constraints, which is also something so that is a thing, one of the many subtleties that are not completely clear to me.
This could be subtle.
How should you have a notion of locality when you don't have a notion of distance?
Well, we have this locality in terms of the gluings we can make on the manifolds.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, this is something I wanted to explain. That for this configuration space or for these principal bundles, now when we have a manifold M, which is composed out of a manifold M1 and a manifold M2, both of which have sigma as their boundary. So now we're getting back towards more the cobordism things, right? So let's say M1 has sigma bar as its boundary, and M2 has sigma as its boundary. So then we can glue the two then we can glue M1 and M2 along sigma, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we get a new manifold N. Now, principal bundles, or what locality here means, is that so we should think of these M1 and M2 as kind of the local parts. And the thing is that given a principal bundle on M1, and given a principal bundle on M2, if they coincide on sigma, we can kind of also glue the principal bundles together and form a principal bundle on M.
At the fixed G.
For Yes. Having G fixed. And conversely, given a principal bundle on M, we can just restrict it to submanifolds like M1. We can also restrict it to sigma and to M2. And in that case, well, they certainly have the property that if we first restrict it to M1, and then from there to the boundary sigma, we get the same bundle as if we first restrict to M2 and then to sigma.
Is it that we call the witness sum? Is it that we call the witness sum?
I don't know. I've heard the term, but I don't know what that means.
What's the term? Sorry.
The witness sum of bundles, but I just don't know.
That's something of bundles. Isn't that something which just applies to manifolds? Well, whatever.
Yeah. It's a witness.
Witness.
Like
witness.
This.
The witness sum. You may be right, okay? That applies to any manifold.
I think it's something like this, no? Like this kind of symbol?
Yeah.
I don't really know what it means in detail. So the important thing is this, that we can restrict manifolds to submanifolds. And when we have, bundles, I meant. And when we have one bundle on M1, another one on M2, if they have the same restriction to sigma, we can glue them together to form a big bundle on M, bundle on the big manifold M.
What sigma again?
The boundary of M1 on M2.
So basically the join between the two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where you put the zip.
So if this is M, we can kind of cut M along this sigma, and we get the left part M1, the right part M2, and the so that sigma is the boundary of M1 and of M2, with one of them being sigma bar, the opposite orientation bar, you know.
In fact, you don't need that the sigma is the whole boundary of M1. It could be a part of.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, we do need that it is kind of the intersection of M1 and M2.
Yeah.
So this kind of thing, when we have, so this is a property of this configuration space. And this property, and I kind of really like this, this is called the configuration space is actually a sheaf of G. That one can glue things in this way. I guess the right term is actually this.
Yeah. What's that? Seriously, I mean, if you have, it's not clear to me that you need sigma to be the entire boundary of the manifold. Because you can imagine bolting three of them together, and for each pair that you draw,
yeah.
Using part of the boundary for both.
Yeah, sure. So basically this in more general cases like that one, it has to just be the intersection of the two, essentially.
So what's a
gerb
when it's a manifold?
What's what?
G-E-R-B-E.
What is it? A sheaf of groupoids or something like that. But maybe I'm not going to get into that.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know the precise definition
at
the top of my head.
Yeah. I mean, you don't have time to really go through it properly.
Yeah. So then locality, in fact, all locality of the action of the measure is also defined in terms of these things in a certain sense, but I'm not sure exactly how. But it has to mean that when you calculate. So when we start with a bundle on the big manifold, then the action of this bundle should be equal to the sum of the action restricted to of the bundle restricted to M1 and the bundle restricted to M2.
So that makes it sound a lot like an area.
Yeah.
Right, is that the punchline then, that it is an area?
No. It's a function of the bundle, not just of the manifold, right?
So it's what, a directed area?
It has nothing to do with area. We don't have any notion of area here, right? This is all just topology.
Okay.
Also the bundles. I mean, the bundles are just the topology.
Did you explain us what is the automorphism of phi?
Yes, I tried, but no, I guess I didn't. But no, okay, sorry. I meant the automorphism of the bundle as opposed to phi.
Okay.
All right. All right, so this defines the theory, kind of this toy theory, and
okay, I see what's, maybe I don't, but I would like just to mention that locality that you said ensures you that you can decompose the action in two parts, isn't it? This is what
you can decompose it into as many parts as you want.
So
whatever way you cut up the manifold, it should be a And this is kind of the...
So if you have the another property that you can factor the measure, so the whole stuff become a factor, you can factorize it. I think behind of this, you have that idea of factorization of this action, I mean, of the path integral.
You have what?
You have the idea of factorizing the path integral.
Oh, yes, exactly, yeah.
Okay,
yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So it's, it's about that.
Mm-hmm.
If you can decompose the action and decompose the measure, that's it, okay? You can just decompose this in several pieces.
Yeah.
Okay.
That is kind of the whole, also the whole point, in a sense, of the, what makes the functorial idea work, that when we fix, so this is also like calculating path integrals, no? In a path integral, we fix the boundary conditions, and then integrate over all possible things in between. So now when we, let me just finish this, when we fix, now let's say we have stuff happening here, stuff happening there, and then in the end. So sigma 1, sigma 2 in here, and sigma 3, if we calculate the path integral, so when this is then now space-time, calculate the path integral from sigma 1 to sigma 3, well, we just integrate over all possible stuff that can happen in between. No, but we can also do the equivalently, we can also just take the path integral from, we can fix an arbitrary configuration on sigma 2 as the boundary condition for the path integral here and a boundary condition for the path integral here. And calculate these two separately. But then, in order to get the total path integral for the whole thing, we should also take the sum over these intermediate configurations here. And this is, in this way we get, if we let this thing vary, the configuration here, we can consider this, the set of these configurations, or we can consider the Hilbert space spanned by all these configurations, and in this way we get the operator from the Hilbert space associated to sigma 1 to the Hilbert space associated to sigma 2 to the Hilbert space associated to sigma 3. And in this way we get this kind of functoriality. Yeah?
I still don't see why that thing isn't an area.
I cannot see that.
I would like to see an example whereby, assuming that it is an area, leads to a contradiction.
So, first of all, I don't see why it should be an area, because we don't have any metric here. We have nothing like, this is just a manifold without any additional structure.
Right, now, the point is that we're looking at this back to front, right? In quantum gravity, we talk about the topological quantum field theories, we really like to be able to describe things like area. Now, if we have something, a definition that we pulled out of our ear, right, which just happens to behave exactly like an area and does not lead to contradictions on any of the cases that we look at if we decide that we're going to call it an area, then that will give us a way of defining an area.
So this action...
If it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck, then it is a duck.
This action is not a function of the manifold alone, right? But it's rather a function on the configuration space of the manifold. So in order to define this, you have to fix the manifold and the principal bundle over that.
Can it be some kind of number? I think the major is something you can call.
Yes, yeah. And that, so it assigns a number to each bundle over any manifold.
Right, so this configuration space that we were talking about, why does this not give us a notion of distance and area?
Why would it?
Because it's a space.
Well, yeah, it's a topological. No, it's just a finite set.
Right.
For each manifold, we have this finite set of possible bundles over the manifold.
Okay, well, I mean, maybe I'll...
Saying space is maybe a bit of a stretch, but yeah.
Maybe it's an area of some module in space.
Right,
and I mean, maybe the... Because the manifold is no metric. So, I mean, we do get numbers associated to manifolds, namely this partition function here. We just calculate the functional integral over the configuration space.
Right, if I've got something like a partition function, that suggests you're getting something that looks like statistical mechanics coming out of this thing. And then you say, oh, right, the Kingston bound, now I have an area.
What can you say?
I have statistical mechanics, right? I can define a notion. If I have a partition function, I can define things like entropy, right? This is standard step back, right?
Yeah, but I don't know what this means in this case.
Right, well, I mean...
It's just the...
We don't have any... Keep in mind that we don't...
A partition function, it better behave like a partition function.
Keep in mind that we don't have any parameters here. We can vary. You know, in statistical mechanics, you have parameters that you can vary, like...
Okay, well,
I don't know. And then you calculate things like the...
If you say partition function to me, I think partition function as in statistical mechanics. If it's something else...
It's just this.
Something else.
It's just this.
Well, that's just an action tool. That could be anything depending on what phi is.
I guess it doesn't.
Right. I mean,
phi goes over the configuration space.
Yeah, right. Now I have this set of functions, right? These various widgets and constructions and integrals and measures and whatever that I've just constructed. Now I would argue if those are isomorphic, as in the same shape, to stuff that looks like statistical mechanics. And I can write down another widget which happens to be the same shape as the Bekenstein bound. I would argue that that's actually what it is.
Okay, well, feel free to do so, but I'm...
Right, I mean, I thought half the moral of category theory is that if you have an isomorphism between two things, then they are morally the same thing. And for all practical purposes, they are the same thing. And the claim
right.
that they are different things
yes.
is artificial and wrong-headed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, but you should... Take care of the details and make sure to get the details right.
Right. Okay. So if the details do not line up,
and maybe
we should
understand this first in detail before jumping to any conclusions about equivalences to other things.
Okay. Well, sometimes you need a way of showing something is to exhibit a non-example. So if you want to support the claim that this
right.
thing is not an area, please show us an example in which it breaks.
I don't know how to do that because I don't even know how to talk about an area in this framework.
Right,
so I can.
It's a definition.
Huh?
Right. I have my bunch of widgets. Right. Emerging from shuffling these widgets around, I get this thing which may or may not be an area.
What do you mean? Wait. What do you mean by an area?
Well, I'd say I have a function or a construction or whatever you want to call it, which behaves exactly like an area under the set of manipulations that we are doing to it.
Yeah.
Right? And, if it always behaves as an area would, if we have one, then I'm saying that that's what it is. Right? So basically, if it looks like a duck and it walks like a duck and it sounds like a duck, then it's a duck. Right? If it looks like an area, it behaves like an area, and it varies like an area, then it's an area.
Okay, feel free to call it an area if you want.
It doesn't really matter.
So,
right.
But I'm going to call it a partition function of the theory.
Right. Okay, so this partition function is allegedly not an area, so there's some...
So there's a formula for it?
...difference between it and an area.
Whatever, I find it misleading to think of it as an area, but... Maybe other people don't, but that's up to them.
Okay, well, I mean, if you can say, if you can establish that it behaves like a partition function, then it's a partition function. But is it a partition function in the StatMex sense?
So it's a partition function in TQFD sense, and that's what people call it.
Okay, well, they can call it a an order for all I care. It doesn't make any sense.
It might not make sense to a person knowing statistical mechanics, but
it's just
different.
Well, you know, I mean, the name of the game we're trying to do at some point is to construct things like, say, you know, gravitational thermodynamics, right? So sooner or later, we're going to want to define something, right, and call it a partition function because we're attempting to do gravitational thermodynamics. And if we've got some other widget
this has nothing to do with gravitational thermodynamics, sorry about that. But
yeah, but you want your category theory to eventually wind up over there. I mean, this is a toy example, but we would like some more complicated version of this.
Okay, then we can talk about that once we get there.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, what's Ed Witten doing playing with
gravity? Anyway, so if one can calculate this, and it turns out that this is just, I guess we don't have time now to show this calculation, and I also don't understand it well enough to say, but it turns out that this is just essentially cardinality of this divided by the cardinality of the group. I guess it's not very interesting, but it's at least, so this shows that it's an invariant of the manifold. And
an invariant, you mean by?
Like a topological invariant. And if one goes to more interesting theories, one actually also gets interesting topological invariants, which are powerful for topologists, like things called itemized torsion. Valentin mentioned this briefly 2 weeks ago, which are really topological invariants, which are in a sense, in some cases, more useful than homology, cohomology, and homotopy. All right. So now I guess it's we're close to the end. I guess I can't show the calculation of the Frobenius algebra really anymore. But now, just to give the idea, what one would have to, starting from this kind of data, one now constructs the Hilbert space associated to the circle, right? So this was the first piece of data we need to get the Frobenius algebra defining the functorial TQFD, is the Hilbert space associated to the circle, right? So to get that, we just calculate the configuration space of the circle. So in this case, it's just the homomorphisms from the fundamental group, which is just the integers in this case, to the gauge group G. And because it's just the integers, well, the homomorphism is determined by the image of 1. So we can identify this configurations, the configuration space of the circle with group G itself. Just, you know, the phase picked up by going once around the circle that defines the principal bundle and conversely. So, and the Hilbert space should then be, sorry, no, wait, what am I saying? Oh, in fact, I forgot something kind of important at the relatively beginning. One has to divide out by these gauge equivalences.
I just saw it's not equivalent.
Huh?
Because I feel this equation is isomorphism.
Oh, okay. Does it look better now?
I think it's better.
Yeah, sorry about that. So, well, G acts on this thing by conjugation and I guess it's, So this configuration space is then going to be set of conjugacy classes of G, right? Because so G here acts by conjugation. So what we need to take is the set of homomorphisms round Z to G modulo equivalence under conjugacy, and that turns out to be the set of conjugacy classes of the group G. Now, in order to get the Hilbert space, we should just take, as usual, take wave functions on configuration space. So that means, in this case, the configuration space is finite, so it's just all complex-valued functions on that configuration space. And so this turns out to be, well, this is something which is known from things like representation theory, and this is called, well, the space of class functions. On the group G. So another way to write this is to say that this is, so this is the Hilbert space of the theory, and this is the space of functions f from the group to the complex numbers, which are invariant under conjugation.
And that's the wave function, isn't it?
Yeah. So this is just the standard procedure, right? To Hilbert space of wave functions over the configuration space of the circle.
You don't care about the L2 stuff?
Well, in this case, no, because everything is finite.
Okay.
Configuration space is finite, right?
Mm-hmm.
So L2 is just everything. Okay, then just as the last thing, maybe now, how do we get these operators associated to the TQFT? So, for example, for the pair of pants, so we have our Hilbert space here, these class functions, tensor class functions. So an operator here is defined by sort of its matrix elements, right? So we have a canonical basis in here, just given by the conjugacy classes. So every conjugacy class defines such a class function by saying that, well, we define f of g to be 0 if g does not lie in the conjugacy class, and we define it to be 1 if it is in that conjugacy class. So in this way, we have these conjugacy classes form a canonical basis. And in order to calculate that operator, we calculate its matrix elements, which means that, and in order to calculate a matrix element, that basically means that we fix a configuration on each of these circles. Because of, well, the basis element here is just the configuration. And the matrix element then means we fix these configurations and we evaluate the functional integral over the remaining freedom we have on the configuration space of the whole manifold. So this is like, you know, calculating the path integral in quantum mechanics. Right? Fix the boundary conditions and let everything in between fluctuate and do the integral over that. And we should do the same thing here. Fix the boundary conditions and do the integral over the remaining freedom of the fields on the bulk. And that defines the matrix element, and this way we get the operator associated to this pair of pins. And in this case, it actually turns out to be, so we can consider these class functions as the center. This is actually the center of the group algebra. Center of the group algebra G. Yeah, I can explain why if necessary. And this center. The multiplication we get on the on this space of class functions . So as we saw last time, this thing defines the structure of an algebra, right? It's a binary operation on our Hilbert space. This turns it into an algebra, right? And this multiplication, this algebra structure, is precisely the one on the group algebra. So it's basically given by multiplying the group elements, just the group operation. Yeah, and there's also the other additional data is this, right? And this just means evaluate the class function on the unit element. Okay. So this gives them this commutative Daguerre Frobenius algebra.
Okay. This is the official taking over the course.
Yeah.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you.